would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give a talk again at Bootstrap. It's always nice to be here at PI for me, since it's where it all started for me. Okay, so I want to tell you guys a little bit about some work we did with Tom Hardman and Amir Tajdini, who's a grad student at Cornell. The title of the talk is Fast Bootstrap and Application to 3D Gravity, so the talk will be in two parts. First, I will describe to you some algorithm that applies to a particular class of Bootstrap problems. And the algorithm is quite a bit faster than the techniques that we're currently using to do numerical Bootstrap, so I'll describe to you how that works. And then in the second part, I'll apply these methods to a particular problem of interest, which is modular Bootstrap, and trying to get some constraints on 3D gravity based on ADS-CFT duality. So as we know, Bootstrap has been a very successful program in constraining the space of CFTs. There is both numerical result and some analytic results. In fact, we heard about some analytic results from Sasha yesterday. So let's see, Bootstrap. There's some analytic results, and the majority of these come in the form of some asymptotic statements, taking some parameter large. So for example, yesterday we heard about how the large delta regime is controlled by the Euclidean LPE, and there's numerical results, which is what I'll be focusing on today. And on top of being able to rule out space of CFTs, in addition, numerical Bootstrap has given us access to the low-lying part of the spectrum of CFTs. So this is useful when you're trying to look at phase transitions, you want to identify the relevant deformations and so on. But for some applications, you need to know the rest of the spectrum. Applications such as if you want to do thermal physics, you need to know the rest of the spectrum. Or from a holographic point of view, if you want to look at gravity, you want to be able to know what are the heavy states in the theory. So what about the heavy operators? And so far, numerics hasn't really given us access to this regime, mostly because, the methods that we use quickly become intractable as we increase the number of constraints. So. For example, hydrodynamics, black hole regime, and ADS-CFT. The methods we currently use is semi-definite programming, and as I said, intractable when you try to access this part of the spectrum. So I would like to introduce a different algorithm. That is not semi-definite programming. Let me just say it in words. So this is the motivation for why we're trying to do this. We need to do something faster to be able to get to the heavy part of the spectrum. Just in words, this algorithm, the way it works is we trade parametrizing the most general positive functional for a particular parametrization of the functional. And then we try to optimize the parameters of the functional. And this turns out to be much faster for a particular class of Bootstrap problems that I'll describe in a minute. And I should say, the methods I'll describe here, most of it is already well known to all of you, but it'll help me just to establish notation, so I'll review Bootstrap. And on top of that, I should say Shear and Miguel already did something very similar to this a few years ago, applied to the correlator Bootstrap, whereas we're applying it to the modular Bootstrap. And then lastly, I'll do applications. If there's no questions about the motivations and the fuzzy words, I'll start. Okay, let me just start then. Start over here. Okay, so the bootstrap. As I said, most of the what I'll say in this section is things you already know, but it'll help me establish some notation. So the bootstrap equations, I'll write them in this way, where these are some positive OPE coefficients. They're positive by unitarity. And this is typically the difference of two crossing blocks or conformal characters. So for example, these W's are either the ordinary conformal blocks or, in the case of modular bootstrap, they're the so-called characters. And instead of crossing, we have modular invariance, etc. These deltas aren't arbitrary, so deltas also have some bounds, so unitarity bounds. And these C's are also positive. So this is the starting point. And then the next step in the bootstrap is to pick a set of linear functionals, and typically we pick a set of derivative functionals. So let me define the following. As an example, these are the functionals we typically pick when we act on the when we're thinking about the crossing relations for four-point functions. And the next step is you choose a set. So you choose a set of these functionals, and for me, I will pick this set to always go from 1 to P. So that's the meaning of P. P will appear in different places in my talk. So it counts the number of functionals. And let me define the action of the functional on the so-called convolved blocks on the difference. So it's simply just the action of these derivative functionals on the difference of the blocks. And let me call this equation 1. So the original bootstrap equation is equation 1. Acting the functional on equation 1 simply says the sum of these functionals, these f's, these little f's, should be 0. And these are what I'll call the primal equations. Primal in the sense of optimization problems. There's usually a primal and a dual set of equations. I'll call these the primal ones. And at this point, as an aside, as I said, this only applies as far as, so far, what we've done only applies to a particular class of problems, which is the simplest possible bootstrap problems that are one-dimensional. That is, I will be dropping the spin label. So an example of such a problem is the modular bootstrap at zero angular potential. So restrict spinless. We have some thoughts on how to proceed to more general problems, but we can leave that for the discussions after. So for example, modular bootstrap tau equals minus tau bar, or SL2 bootstrap, reducing the problem to a line. That's also a one-dimensional problem. So this is just an aside. Now, since I said there's a primal problem, there is also a dual problem, so let me give you a description of that. Football today at 6 p.m. Okay, dual problem. To describe the dual problem, consider the action of the total functional. So take a linear combination of these fi's, which I'll call f on w. Let me define the total functional to be the sum from 1 to p of alpha I fi of delta. So this is what we usually refer to as the functional. And note that there's a freedom here to pick the overall scaling, and in the rest of my talk, I'll pick it such that alpha p equals 1. That's just my convention. And at this point, the bootstrap logic is the following, as you all know. So choose a delta 1, so choose a gap, the first operator above the vacuum in the spectrum, and try to find set of alpha I such that f on vacuum is positive and f on delta is greater than or equal 0 for all delta greater than this delta 1. So if such a set of alpha exists, so if there exists this set of alpha, this spectrum is ruled out. It's ruled out because you can no longer satisfy these equations. A sum of a bunch of positive things can't vanish. And the next step is you minimize with respect to, so you minimize delta 1 by repeating this procedure. And once you get the minimum delta 1, you end up with a functional, which I'll call the extremal functional. And this is the object that is the output of the bootstrap procedure. This is the object out of which we'll extract the spectrum, and so on. And this is the object which I'll be parameterizing in a different way to try to recast the problem. Okay, so what do these things look like? So minimizing this delta 1 lands you at the boundary of allowable regions, and typically following these, this is the curve along which you can see kinks and so on when there is a suspected theory and whatnot. But let me give you a plot of what these things typically look like. So what ends up happening is, so this is the vacuum. This is a typical functional. So this is the delta 1. And notice that the functional above delta 1 is always positive. At most, it can be 0. Because we tried to get it as positive as it needs to be, but not more than that. So it forces the functional to come to the real axis. And this is essentially the boundary case. And at this point, we make the following observation. So the observation is the following. There are single zeros on the vacuum and delta 1. And in addition, there are double zeros. There's p half minus 1 double zeros. So this motivated us to write an ansatz for such functionals. Instead of trying to find the most general function that satisfies these conditions, let's try to parameterize the extremal functional by its zeros. So parameterized by delta sub mu, where the index mu goes from 1 to p half, and the coefficients alpha I, where I goes from 1 to p, but remember I set the pth 1 to 1. So these functions are subject to the following condition. F of delta 1 is 0, and f of delta mu, and f prime of delta mu is 0 for mu greater than 1. So this is the condition that I have a 0 here, and this is the condition that I have double zeros on the rest. So this is a these equations, let me call them equation 2. These are p minus 1 equations for p minus 1 linear equations, in fact, for p minus 1 alpha i's. This means that if you give me a set of operators on the spectrum, you give me a candidate, I can immediately construct the functional for you. Since this is a linear equation, so there is a unique solution. Unique function. Okay, so our strategy will be to we'll try to, so just in words, at this point I haven't said anything about the value of the function on the vacuum. So the strategy that we'll have will be to try to push this up as far as it goes while satisfying those equations. So strategy is to maximize f of 0 over the spectrum with these guys fixed by star. And just based on observation, we know that the solutions, well, by definition, the solutions are extremal. So we can use those equations as well. So solutions satisfy of 0 equals 0 and they're extremal with respect to the spectrum. I.e., you can think of these alphas as functions of the zeros of the functional. So just in summary, in total, we have, there's 3p minus 1, 3p half minus 1 equations for p minus 1 alphas and p half deltas. Okay, so far so good. Now I want to make the following claim. Which is already probably well known. The zeros are a solution to the truncated bootstrap equations. Let me just write the equation. So we just take the ordinary primal equations and we truncate it to include p half states. And I claim that the solution to this procedure the zeros that come out are solutions to the truncated bootstrap equations. And again, these are the primal equations. So that is, there exists a solution to this set of equations that is going to give you the extremal functional. So there exists a solution to this that gives you the extremal functional. And remember, I said if you give me a spectrum, I only have to solve a set of linear equations. So it's trivial for me to check whether the solution that I found to the system of polynomial equations is the extremal functional. Solving these equations does not guarantee me positivity. It'll give me some functional. It doesn't guarantee anything. But it's easy enough to check once you have the solution to the truncated equations that it is giving you the solution. It is giving you an extremal functional. Sorry? It does. Yes. Because this procedure will fix for me the delta mu's, solving this set of equations. And using these equations, I can fix the alphas and construct a functional explicitly. And let me give you a sketch of the proof of the statement.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that C mu's are not functional.
Oh, no, sorry. These are just constant.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. But let me give you a sketch of proof of this thing anyways. And I say a sketch just because I'm going to skip a couple lines of algebra. It follows from essentially Lagrange duality. So we want to maximize the vacuum. So let's write down a Lagrangian. If we want to maximize the vacuum, all my indices are summed over, and I want to impose those conditions over there, and I'm just going to impose them using Lagrange multipliers. So that's the first condition plus so what is this notation? So mu goes from 1 to p half. Nu goes from 2 to p half. I, as I already said, goes from 1 to p. And all repeated indices are summed over. All I'm doing is I'm just writing this optimization problem with Lagrange multipliers imposing the constraints. And so for me, these c's, which are also the OPE coefficients, are Lagrange multipliers, and same with the lambdas. And then to see that the two are equivalent, we do what we usually do, given a Lagrangian. Well, OK, sometimes do. We dualize the problem. Dualize. So that is, we interpret delta c mu, lambda mu, nu as independent variables, and the alpha i's as Lagrange multipliers. okay, we then have a Lagrangian, we know what to do. The equations of motion for the spectrum forces us to set lambda nu to 0. And at this point, I'm making a technical assumption. That is, I'm assuming the functional that I'll find will have at most double zeros. This doesn't have to be true, but based on every calculation we've ever done, I've only seen double zeros at most. So but the final result is not conditioned on this assumption, because essentially the solutions that I'll find are exactly the dual primal outputs of semi-definite programming. So these are, in fact, the optimal solutions. they're the best possible solutions you could get out of this particular numerical problem given your choice of basis for derivatives. And then this problem reduces to, on shell, you get maximize the pth primal equation subject to some constraints. And we're almost done. Just one more step. We impose the extremality condition and the fact that, so impose f of 0 equals 0, and you will, just a couple lines of algebra, you will see that you'll get the primal equations back, the truncated primal equations. So that's essentially it for the procedure. So let me just say in words, what is a procedure? This motivates us to start, like I said, by choosing a different parameterization for the functional, which is parameterized by the zeros. This means there's a lot less equations to solve. Generally, the way semi-definite programming works is roughly you parameterize the functional by writing a basis of squared polynomials. And that's a much bigger basis. In my language, I think it's almost p squared. So there's a lot more parameters to try to tune, to try to get an extremal functional. So perhaps part of the secret sauce to why this thing turns out to be a lot faster is the fact that I'm only tuning only the zeros of the polynomial. But I should say, this came at a cost. The trade-off is that now I'm solving a set of nonlinear equations, so I've given up convexity. The nice thing about semi-definite programming was the problem was convex. So if you found a solution, this was guaranteed to be a minimum. There's no local minima in convex problems. Whereas here, I have the possibility of runaway solutions or finding local minima. In fact, these truncated bootstrap equations, of course, have more than one solution. And it's not guaranteed that the solution that I land on will be the one that gives me the extremal functional. So this is part of the difficulty of what we need to do to try to generalize this to harder problems, such as including spin and so on. This is just maybe just write some things down. Just the takeaway summary, this section is parameterize the functional. Solve 3. I don't know if I labeled 3, but the truncated bootstrap equations. And check it's positive. But check that it satisfies star. And the point is that if you're successful in doing this, you get the most rigorous optimal bounds. And I should say, in addition, we've also eliminated one more step, which was trying to minimize delta 1 itself. Imposing extremality, it turns out if you go through the details of the proof that I skipped, you can show that delta 1 is also fixed. So the gap itself is fixed. So there's no additional optimization step, which you would need to do when you were doing semi-definite programming by whatever bisection method or whatever to try to get the extremal functional. So it's all done in one step. Star was just a bootstrap assumption. Show that it's positive on the vacuum and it's positive above the gap. You can stare at the plot, or if you want to be more rigorous, you can look at the zeros on the real axis. If you don't have any additional single zeros above the gap, you're good. Okay, actually this So this is the first part of my talk. Now I'm going to move on to the application section, unless there's questions. Oh, that's just the truncated bootstrap equations, these guys. Solve them for delta mu and c mu. Solve them for delta mu and c mu. And in practice, what happens is, I was going to talk about what happens in practice, but in practice, what happens is, this is a set of nonlinear equations. In practice, it's not sensitive at all for what you input for c mu. It's, however, somewhat sensitive for the initial conditions for delta mu. So we need to come up with a procedure to put in a good set of initial conditions for delta mu, and I'll describe how that's done. So you solve for the delta mu's. In fact, you can solve for the c mu's exactly in terms of delta mu's. It's a set of matrix equations. You can just plug that in if you want from the get-go and only solve for the delta mu's. But since we're doing things numerically, this is the faster way. Just leave them arbitrary and solve for them. And once you have these delta mu's, you get a set of linear equations for the alphas, which was equation, I labeled it 2, I think. So imposing that the vacuum is vanishing, imposing that the gap is vanishing and that there's double zeros. That fixes for your alphas, given a set of linear equations. Now you have all you need to construct a functional explicitly. And you can check that this functional is an extremal functional. So that's the procedure. Depends what you mean. I mean, it's sensitive, but there's a way of increasing the number of constraints such that you can go to really high orders. So I could, in fact, like as long as I know part of the spectrum, that I can leave the rest of the spectrum somewhat floppy, and it'll still converge to the right spectrum. At least for the faster problems we looked at. I've looked at this for the spinning case for a small enough number of constraints, and it works. But at some point, there's this discrete choice of spin that comes and screws everything up. But there's possibly other ways to go about doing, getting around the fact that this is a sensitive nonlinear set of equations. And I mean, part of the sensitivity is coming from the fact that these are just large polynomials, and the numbers you're dealing with get huge. So you should pick some clever normalization that fixes at least that issue. But I agree, it's not, nonlinear polynomial equations aren't easy to solve.
When you say it's preserving out, it means you're
finding none of the bound? No. The solution runs away. I'll talk about that. Just let me give the applications, and I'll talk about what the initial guess is. You could have landed on a set of a solution to this that will not be the dual primal optimal. It's just a solution to the primal equations, but it's not a solution to the dual equations. But by the duality, it's guaranteed that there exists at least one such a solution that is all that is primal and dual. So that's no. Once you, especially like if you start with like four equations and look at all the solutions, yes, of course, some of them are not going to be. But the way it works in practice is once you start on the primal and you start increasing p, you're close enough to the attraction point of the solutions that you will always land on the solution. Let me put it this way. I find the first like 50 or something, then I can, using that, I can tell you what the next 100 operators are. So I don't go 2 by 2. I don't increase the number of constraints 2 by 2. I increase them by a lot. So in that sense, it's not sensitive, but at the same time, if I just put random numbers, then. No, I use what I know about the fact that at some point, the low-lying operators converge to their actual CFD values, and then I use that to make a guess, to give some random guess as to the next set of operators. Yeah. Could be. Yeah, it could be. I mean, that certainly helps me make the guess in this particular problem that I'll be looking at, the modular bootstrap. But the same thing, I think, is true in the SL2 bootstrap. In fact, those functionals, as we know, by some exact functional magic, are almost the same. Yeah, it could be that when you try to generalize this to the spinning case, it's so irregular that you can't make any progress. So at least not using just this procedure unmodified. We need some new ingredients. I mean, that's why all the song and dance about the caveat and the spin list. But. Okay, so I'll move to the second part of my talk. Quantum gravity questions for bootstrap. So let me just give some motivation, some fuzzy words about this. There's certain types of questions by ADS-CFT that could potentially be answered by bootstrap-type questions, like the obvious one being that is there some, at least in the case of ADS-3-CFT2, where we have modular bootstrap, is there some swampland of quantum gravity theories dual to some CFTs that are just ruled out by UV consistency? Or a nice one is, does quantum gravity require states below the Planck scale? So is there such as, like, does there have to be strings or some KK modes to be consistent with the bootstrap? Another question that's somewhat old is there such a thing as a pure theory of gravity, pure gravity in 3D as a quantum theory? Pure gravity, by that I mean the minimal set of operators you need. So you have the gravitons, and then there's nothing above the vacuum until you hit the BTZ threshold. Is there such a theory? This has an old story. There was a partition function originally proposed by Ed Witten, but then subsequent calculations by Alex Maloney and Ed Witten showed that this thing does not have a proper Hilbert space interpretation. You can't write it as a sum over states of e to the beta h minus theta j, where h and j are mutually commuting set of operators. There's been some additional work since then, but it's in my mind, it's not clear what the status of this problem is. And if, yeah. Shuheng Shao and friends?
Yeah.
It just came out last week. I haven't read it yet, but I don't know if they have the clear cut. Let me put it this way. Even if they can prove to me that pure theory gravity as I defined it is not possible, what is the minimal set of things that I need to put on top of that for me to have the minimal theory of gravity? And that seems like a type of question that potentially bootstrap could answer. If we could push it to the semi-classical gravity regime at large C, for example, and access the operators heavy enough to be black holes. So let me leave that as my motivation. So let me just say, for questions like this, need to look at, let me just put this 3D here. So I'll be just talking about 2D CFT and modular bootstrap in this section. So need large C that controls the G Newton in the 3D dual, and you need to be in the black hole regime theta. That is, I need deltas of order C. Now, G just the problem of modular bootstrap. I think some of the first people to start acting with derivatives on partition functions on a torus, I think, was John Cardi. But then the first bootstrappy type of bound was the Hellermann's bound, for my purposes. So let me just give a rough sketch of the spectrum. So this is the BTZ threshold at C over 12. Hellermann did essentially what I talked about, kept only the first two polynomials, and he found a bound of roughly C over 6 on the gap. And so this is Hellermann. And there was subsequent additional improvement, one by Frieden and Keller, and additional ones by Scott Collier, Yin, and Lin. And they went up to, they used semi-definite programming. They pushed this program up to C's of order 100 and maybe a couple of hundred derivatives. And they were able to improve this bound to roughly C over 8, but we weren't able to get down to the BTZ threshold. And but as we'll see, at those values of C and derivatives, you can see that the values really haven't converged. I'll at the end show a couple of slides as to what the status is now. And you can see at these values, we had really no hope of saying whether this problem can possibly access the questions we were trying to answer. So the motivation is, can this bound be pushed lower? So let's apply these techniques we just developed to this problem of modular bootstrap. So what is the problem of modular bootstrap? You start with the torus partition function of the toroid model, the torus modulus. So you write this as a sum on states labeled by quantum numbers H and H bar, some degeneracies. These are the analogs of blocks for this problem, where these chi's are essentially just traces over the cylinder Hamiltonian. So let me write it in this way. Q to the L naught minus C over. And Q is the standard thing, 2 pi I tau. And typically, it's, we don't work with this object. We work with a simpler object, which pulls out, it turns out the contribution of the descendants can be easily accounted for by pulling out some factors of eta functions. So first, what I'll do is I'll reduce to the one-dimensional problem by setting tau to be minus tau bar, and I'll define that to be I beta. I have so this reduced partition function and this can be written in a way that looks very much like the problem we were talking about. You can write this as a sum on states, where these are the degeneracies, and on real theories, these are actually integers that count the number of states with those quantum numbers. What I'll call g delta mu of beta minus g delta mu of 1 over beta. So this is the crossing equation. This comes from the imposing modular, the S invariance on a partition function. Notice that we're not imposing T, so we're not imposing the full set of modular invariance equations. Then let's choose a set of functionals. There exists for this problem, particularly, well, first let me tell you what these g's are explicitly, since they're simple enough. G of delta is beta to the 1/2 q to the delta 4. And the vacuum is a little different because the globally defined Virasoro generators actually annihilate the vacuum, so you need to account for that. And that just simply gives you so it's just L minus 1 plus 1 kill the vacuum, so you need to subtract that. Okay, so then we choose functionals. They're essentially derivative functionals. The exact form is not important. This is just for convenience, because it gives us a set of polynomial equations that are just Lugger polynomials. They have nice properties, recursion relations, and so on. So it allows us to compute things faster. And then we set beta equals 1. So these are my functionals. Acting these on the functionals, I get essentially the equations that I had before, so I can just directly apply my method. C mu k of delta mu. And these C's are almost the degeneracies, but I've absorbed an exponential. And these F's, as I said, are simply just Lugger polynomials, which makes life easy. Okay, so at this point, we're in a position where we can directly apply the methods we were describing before. So what is the goal? The goal is to numerically solve these truncated bootstrap equations. So we truncate to some p. We try to find a solution. So the goal. Is to solve to some large value of p. Now, I'm gonna break the rules a little bit and spare you my terrible drawing skills by showing you how this works on some slides and answer the question you had about how it is that we make the initial guess. If I could have my slides. Okay, so the way this ends up working is I start with, like, initially I don't know anything about the spectrum. I start with, like, setting p equals 6, so I only fix 3 zeros. And this gives me some solution. That's the first set of lines. I add 2 additional ones. It's still not enough variables for it to become super sensitive, so I can still solve it. And at this point, I notice a pattern. I notice that the plots of the spectrum actually have this self-similarity, which is what Scott was referring to. Look, the spectrum is kind of simple. So you can use this to gradually increase the number of constraints you're going to impose by giving you a good set of initial conditions to solving the primal equations. And in fact, this persists if you go to large number of constraints. So this is 110 versus 200. In fact, you can almost superimpose the two of them on top of each other. And that alone is good enough to get you close to, like, percent level accuracy to what the higher spectrum looks like. And this issue that I was talking about earlier, the fact that at C equals 100 and at orders of 100 derivatives, you can look at how fast things are converging. So at C equals 12, the blue plot, this is what I'm plotting here, is the value of the gap as a number of increasing constraints. Different colors correspond to different values of C. You can see as you increase C, it gets harder and harder to converge. So this is why we really needed to go to higher and higher derivatives to try to answer this question on a large CCFD. The fits are, the convergence is exponential. It's exponentially faster. In fact, the way we extract the C infinity values is by fitting these things to some constant plus some exponential decay. And you can, you know, check that you're not just doing numerical magic and these things are really converging. I mean, it's somewhat obvious from the plots, but. Sorry? Yeah, it's exponential in P. And this is the final result. So this is looking at the value of the gap as a function of C. So here I'm plotting delta 1 over C. And the dots on top of the red thing, the red curve, are showing different values of P, what the gap is. And the red line is showing what it's converged to. So if you look around like C equals 100 or 200, where the previous numerical result was, there was not really near any region where you could say, we converged, so the value of the gap is at large C is around C over 8. With this, we have some reasonable, like, I mean, of course, we can't prove anything. This is numerical. We have some reasonable hope that this is converged. And it doesn't look like it's converging to like C over 12. So we didn't achieve what we set out to do, which was try to push this gap down to C over 12. It converges to C over 9.8, and it's independent of the fit. You can pick different fit functions. You always get C over up to, the change will be in the second decimal place. So it's around, it converges to C over 9.8, and there's some logarithmic corrections. Now, that is not to say that, you know, this problem, it could be that imposing constraints on the spinning bootstrap problem will get you down to C over 12 or closer, but that's an issue we haven't been able to solve. The last thing, here's the spectrum at C equals 500 at some large value of P. I'm here only plotting every 15th operator in the spectrum, because otherwise it'll be too dense. And just what I wanted to point out is that that dashed line is coming from an exact set of functionals, which you will probably hear about next week. And you can see that, so they have exact analytic functionals that give you some upper bound, but these bounds are typically weaker than the numeric. So if you look at the region where I zoom down to the corner where we read the gap, the numerics are typically a little bit below, except at two magical values of C, where the analytics and the numerics match exactly. Those are C equals 4 and C equals 12. The numbers match, and the C minus 4 over 8 plus mu is the prediction that's coming from the analytic functional. So you see that for the higher, for some region in the spectrum, the line actually matches the predictions from the analytics. And these are all the plots I had. The one thing I just wanted to show you was that C equals 12. If you can, you go to high enough derivatives, and what you'll get, you'll numerically get integers out of a bootstrap program, which is always kind of nice. You can compute the OP coefficients, you can compute the degeneracies, and you'll get things that are integers up to many, many zeros. But in fact, in the case of C equals 12, what we get is the Klein invariant J function, the corresponding to the Leech lattice. But this is somewhat surprising. This shouldn't have happened. This is the partition function. This corresponds to a chiral theory, whereas we didn't have a chiral theory. In fact, the vacuum that I used was not the vacuum for the chiral theory. So I can't tell you why this is happening. It's giving the Klein invariant J function, but I can give you an explanation, which is the existence of these analytic functionals. So we get exactly this partition function up to some constant, but you'll probably hear more about this next Thursday. And just a plot of the benchmarks for how much faster this type of thing is, and trying to motivate you to try to think about this problem of parametrizing the functionals in a different way. So this is a log-log plot, and of course you can't push the semi-definite programming too high, but the problems that we solve typically take around 30 minutes on a laptop. If you try to say solve the same problems using semi-definite programming, it's about 10 to the 6 times slower. So it would take you 32 years or something. Okay, so let me just conclude. So Srivanathan Modi, so the summary is we parametrize the functionals in a different way. We solve the truncated bootstrap equations, and this allows us to get a set of rigorous bounds on the CFD data. I already commented on this. This allows you to tune less parameters to try to solve the bootstrap equation rather than trying to solve for the most general possible functional. Seems like a good thing to do, but at the same time, it comes with the caveat that we lost convexity. So this, because of this, we can't, we have to be more careful in the way we solve these equations. It's not always guaranteed that we find the optimal solutions, which is also what makes it difficult to try to attack the spinning bootstrap problem, because in that case, there is not just one functional you're trying to find. You're trying to find a functional for every spin. And in fact, I would claim that the correct thing to look at is to look for a functional as a function of both delta and s, looking at the delta s-plane for a pattern of how these zeros look like. In fact, if you do that, you'll see some patterns, at least for the case of modular bootstrap, where the delta and s dependent is very easy. There is some pattern, some nice pattern that might help you be able to make progress with putting in the initial conditions. So, but I'm not holding my breath for just being able to guess the spectrum, especially if you have some interacting CFD. I don't expect it to be some simple pattern. So you need some new ingredients if you want to go beyond this one-dimensional problem. Somehow trying to restore convexity using some nonlinear version of Danziger algorithm or some other things, or some dynamical way of generating the guess. If the guess runs away, try to somehow dynamically fix it. But let me stop there. Thank you.
Hey, so I had a question. The result you showed, you had these numbers that were very close to being integer, like 10 to the minus 37.
Yeah.
And in principle, you have no way of imposing that. Do you have a way of imposing that the multiplicity of your operators is an integer?
No, or? Well, I mean, I'm sure there is algorithms to solve for things that are integers, just restricting to integers. But notice that, like, once you go to the error there is 10 to the minus 33, but this is only the second operator in the spectrum. And you can explicitly match these C's to Cardy's formula. And as you know, Cardy's formula grows exponentially fast, the OP coefficient. So at some point, the relative size, of the absolute size of the error is staying the same, but the relative thing, so at some point, you no longer, the exact solutions to the truncated bootstrap equations are not really integers. So. Well, especially when you try, I mean, the name of the game here was to go to high enough values so that you could say something about the higher end of the spectrum. So I'm not sure if there's much to be gained, but maybe imposing the fact that it's integer will somehow help you land on actual CFDs. I don't know too much about optimization restricted to the space of integers.
Okay, thanks.
So can you comment more on this C over 12 issue? Because I think I don't understand very well why do we expect C over 12? If this is a Planck-sized black hole, why don't we have like order one quantum corrections? Why do we trust this number or have any expectation about this number?
Well, I guess you could, from an ADS perspective, you could try to explicitly count the saddles that would possibly contribute. Now you're saying, but there's quantum corrections to this. I guess the quantum corrections would be suppressed, 1 over C suppressed. So that's one reason, and especially when we're trying to go to high enough C so that it's really the semi-classical gravity regime we're trying to get at. So in that sense, that's why we expect the BTZ, or at least something close to the BTZ should be the gap.
Even for a Planck-sized black hole, a Planck-mass black hole, you expect the quantum corrections to be parametrically smaller.
Unless so you're saying that the two scales are competing with each other, so who told you it's just going to be 1 over C suppression for the loop correct? Is that your objection?
I'd like to ask a question about the method. So suppose we just solve a problem where the spectrum definitely is going to be some random, you know, some easing model. There's going to be a lot of irregularity. If there is some magic algorithm that just allows you to replace an optimization problem by just going straight for the functional which solves the optimization problem, then I would think that such things probably would have been known already. So
maybe
aren't we like?
I mean, I wasn't around in the early days.
So here you found a very nice way to leverage the fact that the solution had this amazing regularity, but for a random problem.
Well, okay.
Don't imagine.
I wasn't around, but back in the days, people weren't really doing semi-definite programming at some point. There was other algorithms that allowed you to, all I'm trying to advocate is that trying to solve for the most general possible function when we know the output of the optimal solution is going to be just a function that has double zeros in such a way and single zeros. You agree that no matter how complicated the spectrum looks, this is always what the functional looks like.
Then you're saying that there is some magic algorithm which solves any program with continuous set of constraints.
This was the simplest possible algorithm, which was, look, I can put in initial conditions. But it's possible to include another algorithm where you move the zeros around and try to optimize some parameter dynamically. It's possible that maybe this is not the case, in which case we should just go back to parameterizing the most general thing. But I would find that very surprising that I have to parameterize the most general possible functional and wait for it to reduce to a function whose form I know. I feel like there should be a better way of trying to optimize the parameters that fix the functional who has the correct form, as opposed to spending all this time optimizing, bringing the functional to the extremal form, which is going to have double zeros and single zeros.
So this applies to any problem with continuous set of constraints, like any problem that people out there are solving.
Well, I don't have this magic algorithm.
So if you solve this problem, then you would be able to like simultaneously solve any problems in mathematics with continuous sets of constraints.
I'd
much
say
faster.
So. I mean, just my crappy algorithm, I've applied it to the spinning case, which doesn't have a regular. The problem there is like coming up with the initial guess and just, I'm using the stupidest optimization. I'm just doing Newton, which is like, it's not smart. It doesn't know anything. It just tries to land, go the gradient, go the fastest descent. There's probably more clever algorithms since, you know, these are just polynomial equations. There's probably a more clever way of landing on the solutions.
Okay, I had another question. So there was another detail of which played a big role in Scheer and Miguel's thinking was that if you have a problem which has a continuous parameter, like C in your case, then you can flow in this parameter, and that also saves time. Here, did you have to use that idea, or did you just treat every C?
No, we didn't bother. It was like fast enough, but I'm sure we could leverage that to try to make progress that way also. And just one other thing I want to say is that something that I didn't mention here is if you look at the operators and the way they show up in the spectrum, the low-lying operators end up converging and they stay put for the most extent. So it's kind of, it kind of has the flavor of effective field theory where the operators at the high end, they move around, they're floppy, but what's at the bottom, it seems like those guys up there are just working very hard to satisfy the bootstrap equations, whereas the operators down there are staying. So it's not that every time I increase the number of constraints, I need to come up with a brand new guess for all of the spectrum. So it's not, the problem isn't as bad as that, but for guessing the initial conditions. So this kind of gives me hope that there is a possible algorithm to try to fix the lower end of the spectrum and then find a way of fixing the floppy ends to find the solutions to the bootstrap equations.
Can you pictorially show how these FIs looks like?
FIs?
Yeah, these functions, these functionals. Each.
These?
Yeah. What does it look like? And
sorry, FIs or sum on alpha I FI. Yeah, FIs are just Laguerre polynomials.
Yeah, but what do they look like? They have poles at.
You want to know what the functional looks like in the complex plane? Is that what you're saying?
Well, in the real plane, essentially.
In the real plane, it just looks like what I drew before. If I understand your question. Oh, what did Laguerre's look like? They're just some orthogonal polynomials. I forget the exact form. I think the first one is one. And
okay.